WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist Russell Banks. The Dictionary of Literary Biography describes his novels as trailer park fiction, books about working-class people living their lives one step up from the lowest rung on the socioeconomic ladder and doing battle every day with the despair that comes from violence, alcohol, and self-destructive relationships. Banks is the author of Continental Drift, Affliction, and The Sweet Hereafter. His latest novel, Rule of the Bone, is about a 14-year-old nicknamed Bone, who has all the signs of increasing alienation. He wears a mohawk, has his nose and ears pierced, is doing lousy in school, hangs out at the mall, and spends all his money on marijuana. The book opens with him stealing from his mother and stepfather so he can buy more marijuana. His parents throw him out of the house. After taking up with bikers and drug dealers, Bone crosses the line and turns into a real criminal. I spoke with Russell Banks when the novel was published in May. It's written in the voice of the boy. Here's Russell Banks reading from the opening of the novel.
Anyhow, my life got interesting, you might say. The summer I turned 14 and was heavy into weed, but I didn't have any money to buy it with, so I started looking around the house all the time for things I could sell, but there wasn't much. My mother, who was still like my best friend then, and my stepfather Ken had this decent house that my mother'd gotten a divorce from my real father about 10 years ago, and about that she just says she got a mortgage, not a house, and about him she doesn't say much at all, although my grandmother does. My mom and Ken both had these cheesy jobs and didn't own anything you could rob, at least not without them noticing right away it was gone. Ken worked as a maintenance man out at the airbase, which is like being a janitor, only he said he was a building services technician. And my mom was a bookkeeper at the clinic, which is also a nothing job, looking at a computer screen all day and punching numbers into it. It actually started with me roaming around the house after school looking for something that wasn't boring, porn books or videos maybe, or condoms, anything. Plus, who knows, they might have their own little stash of weed. My mom and especially Ken were seriously into alcohol then, but maybe they weren't as uptight as they seem, I'm thinking. Anything is possible. The house was small, 4 rooms and a bathroom, a mobile home on cinder blocks like a regular house, only without a basement or garage and no attic. And I'd lived there with my mom and my real dad from the time I was 3 until he left, which happened when I was 5. And after that, with my mom and Ken, who legally adopted me and became my stepfather up until now. So I knew the place like I knew the inside of my mouth.
Russell Banks, thanks for reading that. Tell me how you decided to open the book with the son trying to rob his parents so he could get money to buy some marijuana.
Well, I think I was looking for an occasion that would let a kid, this kid, sort of drop out, drop through the safety net, the last and maybe the only safety net he had and most kids have, which is basically the family. And I had talked to a lot of kids older than this one, you know, in their teens and early 20s, and asked them and just over the matter of time had learned that they had been living on their own, ended up living on their own, oftentimes for a very trivial offense, the kind of thing that almost anybody is capable of doing when you're 14 or 15, robbing a car, robbing somebody, getting into dope or something like that. And it just seemed like the kind of event that would naturally occur to a kid, but might have disastrous consequences. And stealing his mother's coin collection in order to buy weed with was that kind of event. I mean, it's sort of like that's the final straw, you know, that I was looking for. And it's only a straw, but it's the final one. And then he's out, and he's on his own.
How did you know the kids who you talked to about this?
Well, they're all around us, I guess, so just generally, but in particular, I teach college kids, I've raised 4 kids myself, and also I was a couple of years ago working, doing a creative writing workshop with a friend at a prison in upstate New York, and was dealing mostly with 18 to 22-year-old guys who were mostly drug dealers and had all been living on their own, more or less, since they were, you know, in their early teens. And so one of the things we had them writing about was how they came to live on their own. When did you fall out of the nest? And they all told stories more or less like that. Well, you know, I stole a car or something, or I got into a fight, or, you know, they had dropped out of school, and the pieces of their life were falling apart. Their lives are so fragile, and the support systems that surround them are so basically ineffective in dealing with a little crisis, that, you know, by the time they were 15 or 16, they were on their own and on the streets.
Were there places in writing Rule of the Bone where you felt you least understood what this character would do or say?
That's a good question. But I have to be honest with you. I don't think so. I think once I was listening to him and sufficiently immersed in his world, I pretty much felt confident that I knew what he would do in a given situation. I didn't always know what the situation was going to be, certainly. But no, I don't think that I had to puzzle it out too deeply or too carefully. It just seemed to come to me very quickly and automatically.
You have some things in common with the character in your book. Your father was abusive. You were a rebellious teenager. But you were rebellious, 30-some-odd years ago. Were there mysteries that this character had for you that were partly maybe because of the times, because he's rebelling in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and there are some things from what he might get tattooed to what he might be listening to, mm-hmm. to how he's going to act out his rebellious feelings, you know, that would be different from yours.
Oh, yeah, sure. The main thing, I think probably the most obvious thing, is drugs. When I was 16, I stole a car and ran across the country and disappeared for 3 months and, you know, did some of the destructive and angry things that the Bone does and that a lot of kids do. But there wasn't the danger. I couldn't step into the world of drugs that easily and that quickly. I would have had to have really worked hard to do that. And this was, you know, in the late 50s. And Bone doesn't have to work hard. It's in the air he breathes. I mean, it's easier for kids to buy illegal substances than it is for them to buy alcohol when you're under 16. Much easier. And it's just in the world for them. So that's a huge difference. The whole drug culture is a huge difference. And the drug economy, when I was a kid, it was a tiny sub-economy. I mean, it didn't really exist as such. But today, it's a major part of the economy. So that's a huge factor, difference. The other difference I know, looking at Bono when I got into him, was the issue of race. America was much more segregated when I was growing up. And you could grow up a white kid and into adolescence and drop out and move about the country and so forth. And if you were a white kid, you would never really be forced to deal with the issue of race. It was still a kind of invisible topic for you, unless you happened to end up in unusual circumstances. Whereas for Bone, it's there instantly.
Did you steal from your parents?
Sure. Did you?
Actually, no. And I'm not just saying that because they might be listening. No, I really didn't. So what did you take?
Oh, small things, you know, things I wanted for myself. The worst thing I think I did was I stole, well, should I be saying this on national radio? I stole my grandfather's watch and claimed that it was my own and was eventually caught. But it was a kind of a symbolic act, I think, because my grandfather was a watchmaker. And I guess maybe I was trying to steal his identity in some way.
Did you try to pawn it? Or did you just want the act of claiming it as your own?
I just wanted the act. I wanted to wear it, and I wanted it on my arm. But I stole a car. I stole. I didn't steal with any compulsion, I don't think. I shoplifted. I think a lot of kids do that. Try it out. It's testing the limits, testing the edges, I think, trying to define the cause and effect of relations between yourself and the larger world.
Some of the characters in this book are substitute father figures for Bone, for the teenager. One guy is big in the Hell's Angels. Another guy is small in kiddie porn. There's a Rastafarian who basically becomes his mentor. Do you think a kid with an abusive father is basically an easy target in a way for false father figures?
Oh, sure. I think that a kid, with an abusive father, without a father, or with a father who himself feels inadequate or unsure of how he's supposed to protect and teach a son or a child of either gender, is bound to go searching for a substitute.
Did you?
Oh, sure, I did, yeah. I mean, you start moving out from your own immediate family almost immediately. As soon as that person in your immediate family fails you, you're going to go looking for it.
Did you find any father figures that led you in the wrong direction?
Oh, sure. And a few that led me in the right direction, too.
I imagine some of the ones that led you in the right direction were writing teachers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What about the guys who led you in the wrong direction?
Well, yeah, there were a couple. there was a guy who was an ex-con who had been a barker at strip shows in Atlantic City that I ended up traveling with. And, when I was a young guy, I'd attach myself to older guys who seemed smarter than I and more at ease in the world than I. And then sometimes, you're lucky. But I don't think I was lucky until I was in my 20s. And then I began to locate men who could, who could see in me what was probably worth saving and nurture that and could give me a sense of self-worth that allowed me to step around and eventually avoid the kinds of behavior that would have put me in jail in upstate New York by the time I was 25.
Now, what do you think the barker from the strip show saw in you?
Well, one of the things he saw in me is I had a driver's license at the time, and he didn't have one. And I could get a car in Miami and drive it across the country. And so he was actually a gambler more than he was a barker. And he was out of jail, and he was gambling, and I ran into him down in Key West when I was a kid. And I was just, I think, around 19. And he took me under his wing, as it were, but he also used me. And I think that's the kind of bad father you get, the one who's using you for something for himself.
Russell Banks is my guest. His new novel is called Rule of the Bone. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Russell Banks, his new novel is called Rule of the Bone. Your father, who was abusive, left your family when you were 12. So while he was part of the family, he was always bigger than you, probably a lot bigger than you. You were a kid. Mm-hmm. Did you ever confront him as a man?
Oh yeah, we made our peace. Actually, I went back and dealt with my father very closely. I even worked alongside him. He was a plumber, and I became a plumber, and worked with him, and even lived in his house for a period too when I was in my 20s, and became never really affectionate, but close, if that's possible. Was how I experienced it. We were close. I was very involved with him right up to the end of his life. He died in 1979 at 63, when I was in my 30s. And so we dealt. I never, I think, had that kind of vengeful clarification with him, but I didn't really need it or want it by the time I was in my 20s.
There's something that I think I might have asked you about once before, but it still really interests me. You once said that your father felt that moving up in life was a betrayal, that it was somehow a rebuke of the life that he had led.
Yeah.
And unless you were just doing some wheeler-dealer thing and finagling something, in which case that was fine. What do you think is the difference between the impulse to sacrifice for the children so the children can have more than you do, and the impulse to feel, well, why should they have more than me? What's good enough for me is going to be good enough for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a difference in believing in the American dream and no longer believing in the American dream. That if one generation sacrifices itself for the next generation, that next generation will profit from it and move up in society and be empowered in such a way as to make it even better for the third generation. It's that three-generation syndrome. And many Americans have not, after having been here for a long time, African-Americans and white Americans, too, who have gone through 8, 10, 15 generations in America, don't find that that model, that dream, doesn't describe their experience. And I think they grow bitter and mistrustful, profoundly mistrustful, of anybody who separates themselves from them. By moving up, you know, and so forth. It isn't that they just accept their fate, it's that they feel there is no realistic alternative. And if you're advancing yourself in society, you're rejecting them. It's a way of disconnecting yourself from them.
So tell me more about why you think your father felt that, you know, if one of his kids moved up, it was somehow a betrayal.
Well, it probably, since he didn't feel he was sacrificing in his youth. My father's a very bright man, very gifted man in many ways. He was a child of the Depression, went to work in this when he was 16, and dropped out of school and worked with his hands his entire life. And he was bitter about that, I think, and didn't feel as though that was his. He was sacrificing anything. So he was in some ways not connected to his own children, the next generation, to their future. And so by having that sense of disconnectedness, if I didn't live his life exactly, more or less the same, I challenged and humiliated him for that. It wasn't as though, you know, by my living a different kind of life, I validated and justified a sacrifice on his part.
Do you think that held you back for a long time?
I think it injured my sense of self-esteem and made me feel for a long time essentially inadequate and incapable of achieving. I wasn't raised to believe that, really, that anything was possible for me, and that my parents were sacrificing in order to advance me in the world. So, yeah, I think that there was a bit of a disability there. But on the other hand, it made me, in a way, more the master of my own fate, too. I didn't owe anything to anybody backwards in time, you know. Whatever I got, one way or the other, I got it myself.
Was there a teacher who helped kind of counteract that sense of advancement as betrayal?
Yeah, early on, in my early 20s, I had the great good fortune to run into the novelist Nelson Algren. When he was in his late 40s and I was in my early 20s, and it was purely, you know, fortuitous. And he read some of the stories that I was then writing, and I was working as a pipe fitter actually in Concord, New Hampshire at the time, and had gone up to Breadloaf Writers Conference because I admired his work, and I saw his name on an advertisement, and had taken a week off work and drove up to Vermont to be a participant in this conference, and he. This is another case of a guy who was glad I had a driver's license to befriend me because Algren, like a lot of American novelists of the open road, didn't have a driver's license, like Jack Kerouac, and needed me to drive him around, so which I happily did. But he was a little larger than that and had a greater sense of his own responsibility and power than that, and became a kind of a mentor and a model in some ways for me, very important ways when I was a young writer. That lasted, and they last even to today. I mean, I'll still sometimes find myself saying, well, I wonder what Nelson would do now. What would he say here? How would he handle this situation?
Did he help you figure out that you could use the stuff of your life as the subject of fiction?
Yeah, absolutely, that you could bear witness, and that bearing witness was important and at the center of American literature, really, and going back to Whitman.
I want to get back to the teaching in prison that you did, which helped inspire Rule of the Bone, your new mm-hmm. novel. You obviously got a lot out of teaching there.
Well, it's very brief and you know, not an extensive experience, but I was able to extrapolate, you know, from it
very
quickly.
What did you want to give? I mean, did you think, well, I'll help these guys become professional writers?
Oh,
I mean,
no,
yeah, right.
No,
so,
no.
So what was it that you thought helping them to write would give them?
Well, I think perhaps just maybe give them an ability, which they already had the ability, but just help to tap and shape that ability to tell their own story. We all need to construct a narrative for our lives in order to make them meaningful in order to get make moral sense out of them. Otherwise, it's just a kind of kaleidoscope of images and memories, and that's essentially meaningless. And so it was just give them an opportunity to tell their story, to organize, help organize the material, and put it in sequence, and give it some structure, and give them the understanding that their language was sufficiently powerful to construct a believable narrative of their lives. And they were in a context with each other where they could challenge each other interestingly and usefully. They could say, oh, come on, man, it doesn't work that way. Or, you know, come on, man, you deserved that. What are you saying? This is just special pleading. You know, they could they could check it against their own realities, each other's realities, and not get away with anything. And so that was very helpful for them.
You've hit on something that really interests me, the idea that you need to construct a narrative mm-hmm. to find meaning in your life. Otherwise, it's just this wash of
otherwise, we have to inherit experience. The one that's given to us, you know, which is right. often a demoralizing and,
right.
and humiliating narrative. And say, oh, well, you're just that kind of kid, or you're just that kind of man or woman who, we hear those stereotypical narratives all the time, and they're almost always humiliating and demeaning. But the real authentic existential narrative of our own life is what gives it its moral significance and reality.
Well, I really believe that, too, and I mean, that's what I love about a lot of great fiction and nonfiction. And, you know, in a really teeny tiny way, that's what you try to offer on an interview show, is mm-hmm. a chance for those narratives mm-hmm. to be told. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, I have this terrible feeling that in America, everybody is being encouraged now to build these fake narratives.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? To just yeah. kind of like yeah. go on afternoon talk shows
right,
and accuse
right.
your mother of having, you know, hurt you
right.
in some great or small way, and
right.
or to market your story in some kind of public relations
sure.
type of way to sell yourself or to
right.
sell a product. And I feel like everybody's walking around now with the kind of false and true narrative construction of their lives.
All right, I agree. I mean, and so many of them are well, what makes them false is that they're basically simplistic. You explain your life in these really reductive, simplistic, causal ways, rather than admitting into them the complexity of motives and circumstances that actually do create your life.
Russell Banks, his latest novel, Rule of the Bone, was published in May, which is when our interview was recorded. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.